I am Andrew Ron. I'm an accredited rural appraiser, and I am president of the Montana chapter of the ASFMRA.
I'm Coulter DeVries, owner of Ranch Investor Advisory and Brokerage Services. I'm an accredited land consultant with the Realtor Land Institute and proud member of ASFMRA.
The Ranch Investor Podcast is the most downloaded and informative industry-specific content that intrigues while entertains.
John Hansen, welcome back.
Well, thank you for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thanks for stopping in.
Yeah.
To my new office, new studio.
Yep.
Coming along. We've got Andy Ron with us today.
Yeah, good to see you again, John.
Yeah, he's, good seeing you too.
He's holding the mic like it's an episode of comedy with Shane Gillis and Mark Norman.
He's our stand-up guy.
Yeah, yeah. Practice my karaoke.
Well, John, what's new in your world since we last talked to you? You were with Land Trust, and prior to that, Turner Enterprises.
Yeah.
Ted Turner's big bison operation.
Yeah, that, of course, I'm pretty well disconnected from that now, other than I do visit with a few of the employees that were friends. But, you know, since I worked with Land Trust, helping them kind of get inserted into Nebraska, and then I had contacts up here to help them with. But last fall, I started getting busy enough with consulting work and a few other projects that I didn't think I was worth my pay to them. So I told Nick that, you know what, I'm not worth it to keep on the payroll. So
when has that stopped any of us?
Yeah. I try to be honest. So, but, you know, occasionally.
I actually used to hear that a lot from my dad. I never had to tell him I wasn't worth my pay. He would let me know at breakfast and then dinner again.
I think everyone's afraid to tell me that, so I just do it myself. But no, so I haven't done much with them. I stay in touch with them and still do a little now and then if they need some help on something. But you know, since then, just been working with various ranches, helping them. I know on a podcast before you'd mentioned, are you going to be consulting? And I said, only if there's an interesting project. And there's been quite a few interesting projects. I've actually had to turn a few down because I just don't have time. But yeah, right now I'm kind of working to help a family with their ranch in the big timber area and enjoying the heck out of it. So I split my time between here and my place in Nebraska. And it's pretty nice setup. I can kind of move around, do what I need to do and be where I need to be and then disappear for a while. And
16 hours apart is a pretty nice setup.
Yeah, it's only 12.
12.
Okay. Yeah, it's not too bad. It's an easy drive.
A little faster than
you. Yeah, in fact, I'm going to head down Sunday because my fence is in a mess after this winter's blizzards down there. So drifts took everything to the ground. So it's...
Yeah, Nebraska also had some tornadoes this year.
Oh, yeah, that's... fairly common. Not so blizzards much in the and, sand hills or
but
where
they had
I'm at,
sandhill blizzards.
Yeah. They're,
I mean, sorry, tornadoes.
Yeah, they occasionally get in there and touch down, but not quite as bad as farther south or more eastern part of the state. And although north of the sand hills, there'll be a few blow through there once in a while and tear some stuff up. But we've been lucky. We just had the blizzards and snowdrifts 10 foot tall that took everything to the ground. But
wow.
Anyway.
So... two different places, 12 hours apart. What has been, I mean, that you must be really intrigued with what you're doing there to one, get into consulting, because that was a threshold. You need to be intrigued. And now two, making that journey a couple times a month. What's driving you here? What's the motivation behind these places?
Well, you know, my place is fairly simple. It's not very big and it's a, you know, no livestock that I own. You know, I just lease the grass out and got a really good young guy there that I give him a good rate and he keeps kind of track of stuff while I'm gone and whatnot. So that kind of works out well. The place that I'm doing the work with right now, it's I've had some history with them for the last 20 years on and off. And it's a really neat piece of property, very unique. And the owners are fantastic people. I mean, they are just really dynamite people. And also too, is I'm not in it alone because my wife, Janie, is also heavily involved. She's got a skill set that I don't and vice versa. We can kind of fill for each other, but we each have our strong suits. And so a lot of times she'll go down there and take care of stuff, and I'll stay up here and work on my part, and then we'll switch places. And then sometimes we're in the same place together, and it works out really well. So we're both having fun with it. And, you know, it's, you know, for lack of a better way to phrase it, it's kind of like one big blast to make something really nice. And so we really enjoy doing this, and we're having fun. And that's the big thing, is we're just trying to have fun. Absolutely. And of course, a little extra money is okay too.
So are you helping a new venture?
No, this been in this family since the 70s.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, it's been through various changes and ups and downs and, you know, generational shifts and a few things. And there were just some things that weren't working. And they asked if we'd help them get things lined back up again. And so it sounded just right. It's not necessarily a super long term, but long term enough to be interesting and to make a difference.
What are you guys hearing for? What do the people want? What are ranch owners asking for these days?
Landowners.
Yeah. Because consumer tastes and preferences shift. They change. They morph. What are your beat on the street? I mean, John, you're getting calls for consulting. Andy, you're getting data from sleazy ranch brokers. what do the people want today?
Well, we were talking about this before the mic went on. I mean, obviously guest services and recreational, you know, that's the new owner set, you know, is typically got an enjoyment component, you know, bring the family and that kind of thing. So I think a lot of ranches have that baked into, you know, we're shifting. We have been on this shift for a long time from owner operator to, you know, outside owner that has an enjoyment component. I mean, isn't that?
Yeah, definitely. That's a big part of it because, you know, and it kind of comes back to some of the pandemic got people interested in having something that wasn't in town, you know, something where they could sequester away. And then they found out that's kind of a cool thing to do and they really enjoyed it. And so I think that's a big part of it, a place they can come to relax, go enjoy whatever they like to do, whether it's hunting, fishing, or just walking around and looking at things. There's a few that like the aspect of some minor agriculture, you know, and I mean, there's some of the bigger places where they kind of want a big ag component to it, but others want maybe something just a little less, you know, a few cows, some horses, you know, maybe a few chickens or whatever, just to kind of get grounded again a little bit. And then the other part of it that's so interesting, this is what I come across with the people that have contacted me, is they want to improve the land, you know, and I really admire that aspect. And where it comes from, I think a lot of it is from some of the social circles they run in. You know, it kind of started, let's face it, with Ted Turner, you know, let's get this land and turn it to whatever that we think the best view of it is, you know, and there's some places got pretty beat up that are now getting kind of put back together, and they want to do that. And then of course, and I kind of hate even using the term because it's become such a buzzword, but the regenerative ag movement, you know, I mean, that is kind of catching everybody's thing, you know, and
yeah, for sure.
There's various views of it, you know, of what is really regenerative and what is, you know, really good management should be regenerative by definition, but it's not always that way. But they kind of want that, and then they can go to their social circles the rest of the year and kind of talk about what they have and what they're doing. And once in a while, they'll bring guests out, and they'll talk to the manager if he's kind of adept at that, and visit about what they're up to. And then they get to feel good. They're doing something well. They're adding value to the land. They're helping the ecosystem. And I think a lot of them, that's truly, really in their heart that they want to do it. And I admire them for that. Sometimes they get some misinformation on what it takes to get there. But that's the point of a good manager or consultant or whatever, is to bring a little reality to the equation.
I'm sure there's some relationships out there that are pretty brutal. Land managers on the ground trying to work with the owner set that's not informed or doesn't know what they're talking about, and it's just going from like the misinformation side, that's got to be a rough gig. But
trying to implement idealism.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, and that's true. But, you know, I lay it really on the shoulders of the ranch management to bridge that gap. and be sharp enough to do it. Because, you know, let's say the average big mega urban type person that comes out and buys a place, they don't have the background. I mean, they may be financial geniuses and have the rest of the thing figured out. But when it comes down to just good basic ag and how environmental processes work and ecological processes, they don't have the background any more than, you know, throw me into Chase Manhattan Bank and they'd be broke in a week if I ran that place. So no, it's up to a good manager to understand how to communicate with them, bring what is the big ideal down to the granular level of this is how we start. And it usually starts very basic. You know, you start at the base level and build up from it, where a lot of times they're hoping you can just do this one thing and then everything works good. It doesn't work that way. And it's up to the manager to really explain to them. And this is a lot of ag managers really don't have the communication skills and ability to sit down and work. You know, I mean, a good ag manager, he should not only be able to sit around a table with a neighbor and drink coffee, but sit in a boardroom and be totally comfortable and explain what they're up to, why it works this way. This is what you can expect. I lay it on them to do it. And, you know, it takes time and experience to do that. You know, 40 years ago, I'd have been a wreck at doing what I'm doing now. But, you know, just through experience and learning and some really good mentoring and coaching by people I respected, you start to develop that. And I think that's a big thing. And I'm hoping that a lot of these programs that we've got for ranch management now that weren't there 40 some years ago when I went to school, like, you know, that's the right. King Ranch Institute, the Dan Scott program at Montana State, will start to bring this up, because we never knew about absentee owners when I was young and learning this. You know, it was very rare. And if you landed on one of those places, you were a little like a fish out of water till you started to catch on. And so it's really up to the ranch manager to bridge that gap and be good at it and be willing to sit and socialize and to visit and be candid but polite. So, you know, that's kind of where it's at.
So I'm thinking, you know, we've had this generational shift where a generation or so ago, it was more kind of a John Wayne thing, you know, come out and be a badass cowboy. But even though that change is well in motion, you know, we got John Dutton firing up the TV screen. So my next question is, is there going to be a regenerative soap opera plot that's going to take the TV ratings by storm? How's that going to look? I guess it's less sexy TV.
That sounds more like a nerdy Netflix documentary.
Well, at least it'd be more realistic than what they're putting on TV.
What's the train now? What's the train station look like on a, is that going to be a compost,
compost bin? take them out back to the compost pile.
Feed the worms.
Yeah. Take Fred to clean the barn out is the key word.
Right. Yeah. Right. But I completely agree with you that a regenerative and it's funny because, you know, people want to own land and then there's these values that go along with it and doing something positive, which I agree with you, it's a good sentiment and it's admirable when it's implemented well.
Yep. No, I agree. You know, and the thing I'm happy about, the people that are thinking about, you know, regenerative improving land, and here it comes back to the manager again being on top of his game and really having, you know, a good set of thinking processes to put it together. Some of the people come out and they think the best thing we can do is get rid of all the cattle, get rid of, you know, all the livestock other than maybe a couple of horses so they can ride around, that kind of thing. But, you know, just let it go, you know, that whole back to nature thing. Well,
right.
I'm sorry, that doesn't work. It works for a couple of years and looks really good. But about year five, you start seeing problems, sometimes earlier. Where your rangeland becomes decadent, you know, and a lot of people are totally against herbicides. And I'm not like a big spray guy, but there's a time and a place and a set of, you know, noxious weeds or plants that shouldn't be there. Yeah, let's just nip it in the bud. And, you know, I'm not saying, you know, go full Agent Orange on something, but, you know, good spot spraying, an intelligent approach, maybe some biologicals that are practical, that kind of thing. But those things start to show up. You know, it's just real simple, especially like if you take riparian areas, which is always a hot button issue, especially with a lot of the new landowners, a lot of them are fishermen, you know, and we've all seen beat out creeks. And I've seen a lot of them that weren't beat out that went the other way. They were so full of duff, all you get is Canada thistle. You know, and some of these plants like Canada thistle, it either loves completely overrested or completely bombed out and burned. You know, it works the extremes. And you have to explain to them that, yeah, fine, you bought this place that's maybe not been managed the best. Give it rest for a year or two, but start having your plan together. When the time comes, you come through with the proper type of livestock, the proper amounts, proper timing, to keep it freshened up, because all grasslands evolved under grazing pressure. Well, I shouldn't say all, most. There's, you know, some areas that it wasn't such
New Zealand.
Thing. Yeah, New Zealand.
The tussock grasses.
Some of the California, you know, now annual grasslands used to be perennials, but they didn't have the large ungulate populations mm-hmm. that we did on the plains. So when I'm thinking, all my experiences in between the Mississippi and the continental divide.
And Nebraska?
Yeah, Montana, Nebraska, Dakotas, Texas. Anyway, they do, you know, they require a certain amount of grazing. Then it's down to management, timing, all that kind of stuff, and have a plan together. But just lock it up and go away. I've seen some really horrible things happen. And I guess one of the best case in points is when I was going to school at MSU, I was working out at Red Bluff Research Ranch on a research project I had, and I found these old exclosures that had been put in the 50s. Inside the exclosures was a disaster. Nothing had grazed other than, you know, rodents and whatever could crawl through the little wire fence, but no large ungulates. It was a mess inside. Outside, I wouldn't say it was fantastic, but it was a whole lot better. And so, you know, it's just one of those things. Extremes never work. You want to kind of find your way towards the middle and wander back and forth each direction, catching most of it. So,
well, that you, I didn't know we were going to get into ranch management, even though that's what you do. But it makes me think of, we have these somewhat altruistic and values driven goals, and by values I mean personal values. Mm-hmm. And we're trying to squeeze blood from a stone to get a profit out of a ranch, and now you're adding potentially novel, somewhat niche practices that have a payback period. It'll take 30 years to see that. And it just seems like, is this an exercise in futility? Are we doing all this stuff? Does it pay off in the end?
I was just going to say, the flip side of that is people are hungry for something like that, something real and tangible and even maybe long-term, right? Isn't that part of the drive, is something larger than just what sort of tech urban life?
I'm just wondering how it's going to last, how it's going to be sustainable, how you'd sustain something like this if there's no economic incentive.
Yeah, and you bring up a good point. I had a very wise old gentleman. He was kind of a serial ranch buyer. You know, he'd buy places, run them for a while, sell them, then go buy another one. And it was when I worked for Mr. Turner that we bought a ranch he had. And I was out touring around with him, and he said, "I'll tell you what, kid." I was like 40-something, but he was a lot older. So he said, "These ranches have to pay for themselves or they'll eat your lunch." And he said, "I don't care how big your lunch is, it'll eat it." And I thought, you know, there's a lot to that. And I always try to keep that in mind. You know, the first few years a new owner has a place, the ag component, if you're lucky, will break even, depending on how it's set up, how it's been done, what shape it's in. You're actually very fortunate if it does. And a lot of times the new owner's got other things they're doing to the land, which is a big financial draw, like maybe a new house or, you know, pick your poison. There's a lot of things.
Couple gardeners.
Yeah, all that kind of stuff, landscaping, the whole bit. But the big thing is, and this goes back to like the ranching for profit stuff, is you really do have to split it off, is you've got a land business and then you've got these other businesses. And so really look at the land part. And then on the land part, what's using it? Well, you've got to assign those costs and everything to various whether it's the guest services, i.e. personal use of the place, whether it's a cow operation or some hang operation, you know, the basic thing to analyze, see where you're bleeding and recognize it, you know, and in some cases, the fact that you're dumping, you know, 200,000, 400,000, whatever, maybe up to 1 million into the owner's use of the place, fine, just segregate it out. Let them know this is what it's costing you for your enjoyment. And this is what your land is actually producing and can cover. And then they can make an informed decision. Is this worth it to me to have, to spend $500,000 a year to be able to come here and recreate and do all this? And then hopefully the land part's kind of taken care of itself. And when I say the land part, you know, basic infrastructure like fences and corrals are up, you know, hang being taken care of, the irrigation systems working if you've got them or whatever. But then that whole ownership part of it really does have to be separated off. If you throw it into one lump budget, it's so hard to determine what's really happening, because pretty quick the landscaper's getting charged off to hang and he right. doesn't produce anything.
You do quite bring up long-term sustainability culture, but I do wonder, because there is a correlation between, you know, just good management and, yeah. and profitability. And, you know, it's been a frustration over my career as a land appraiser, you know, land productivity and ag productivity often doesn't play a role in land values.
I mean, no.
We get hot enough markets, you know, but the market, and, you know, we're in kind of a correction period right now after 2021 and 22. And one way I'm characterizing it is pencil sharpening. Buyers mm-hmm. suddenly, you know, are sharpening their pencils. And even though most sleazy brokers tell me there's still a lot of demand out there,
they're full of shit. They
all have buyers stacked up in their back pocket and just can't find the right place. But these buyers are sharpening their pencils, and where a year or two ago they might have jumped on something just because it was available, now they're like, ah, it turns out I don't want to be that far from town, or I don't want this, or I don't want that. But the sustainable part, I mean, if the regenerative agriculture and just kind of attention to management sets in, and these places are, and it does take years and years and years, so 10 years, 20 years, whatnot down the road, you know, will appraisers start some, you know, now will productivity and efficiency, you know, places that wash their own face economically, will they be in higher demand rather than, you know, because the frustration in the past is like you got one really well run place next to a place that's been beat to shit, and the market doesn't recognize it. The wife likes the barn on the other place better, and boom, there it goes.
Yeah,
for a higher price.
So this is, I'm going to take my best shot at my train of thought here and circling this back. John, you're a ranch manager. Consumer tastes and preferences over the last 5 years, we'll say, but more particularly probably 3 years with the COVID changes, they have asked of your position to become more of a caretaker in a sense. You're creating an experience, and that experience includes improving riparian habitat. It includes maybe the species dynamic and composition. That's been a demand of your position that has trumped or superseded a demand of your position to produce cash flows, to optimize and maximize profitability. Is that because we are in this hubris, superfluous boom right now, coming off of it, we're in the party, when we can live in a world of extravagance, that these altruistic and virtuistic ideals, they have taken the driver's seat, just because we live in this cash rich extravagant world? If we have a huge correction, will the ag manager, the profitability cash flow guy, will he be in vogue again? It's kind of like the tech companies. None of them had to produce a profit. Are companies going to be cash, companies that produce cash, are they going to come back to vogue? Is it going to shift back to that, where now we're going to demand more out of properties, tangible assets actually producing a positive yield?
I think it's going to have to. Excuse me. You know, you can't have sustainability if you don't have, you know, some profit in the outfit. I mean, you can only, as they say, feed the kitty so long, and pretty quick it's like, that cat better go find some mice, you know, because I'm done buying cat food. And it kind of gets that way there. And so I think the really good managers, and, you know, there's all grades of them. Some have got real strengths towards, you know, ownership relations, making them happy doing that. And maybe they're not as strong in the ag profit production, analyzing what they can do. Other guys are really good at that, but don't know how to really operate with the new owners and that, you know, set of people. You know, they don't have the communication skills. The really good ones are the ones that do both, because really, you know, and it's every place that I'm on, I take a run, a hard line run at the budget, and I've got a set kind of budget procedure that I use. Even if they have something different for their accounting, I don't care. I plug in all the stuff that I see off of their books and records, and then start sorting through and seeing, okay, where are we bleeding? Where do we have a chance to make something? Looking at efficiencies, you know, simple things like, you know, take livestock. You don't have to own livestock to make some money with them. And no different, you don't need to own land to make money with livestock. You don't have to own either. You just have to know how to work it and get the right margins and the scale. But I think that the good manager is going to be always needing to look at what can we do to cover our costs, plus generate as much more than that possible to either hedge against something in the future or to cover something that the owner may want that's going to be a, you know, not a profit center, it's strictly a loss center, but at least smooth that out for them. Because the idea I would, and I've talked to a lot of owners that, you know, they really do envision when they're getting this being something that goes the generations. And oftentimes it doesn't make it that many generations, because the person that made all the big bucks in the beginning, their children don't always necessarily follow the same line. And so they maybe can't afford to take it on or whatnot. So it'll go out. But the point being, if the place is well taken care of, it's set up to be as sustainable as possible under whatever, shall we say, criteria or restrictions the ownership puts on them. Because sometimes ownership will put restrictions on what you can do on the place that are contrary to profit, and maybe feed a personal belief or, you know, something like that. That does happen. And that's a tough one. And that's where sometimes a really good manager can talk them back from that a little bit and, you know, still allow them to have what they want, but maybe not to the extreme degree they were looking at, i.e., I don't want to ever see a cow on my place. Well, fine, that's all right, good and fine. But when you're not here and not looking, maybe we should have some here to do some good and make a little money. You know, it comes back to being really creative, building good relationships, particularly with neighbors, because I haven't ranched anywhere where I didn't have neighbors at one point or another really could use some grass, and we might have had some that they could use. And if you can get the go-ahead, it helps you both, and then you've got a great community relationship going on, and that's huge too. You know, and that's another aspect of a really good manager, is they keep the community close to them and work with them, and you both benefit. And so the whole point comes down to sustainability. There has to be some profitability, or at least, and I don't even like to use the term break-even. Break-even means you're losing ground, in my opinion. But at least you're not losing as much as if you were just out there throwing it away.
Yeah, economic break-even might not be losing ground, but cash flow break-even. Yeah, you can go backwards on a cash flow break-even, yeah, for sure. That still makes me wonder though about these managers. Is there a way to incentivize them? Do managers want to be incentivized for production goals and metrics, or do managers generally just want a salary? And the reason I asked, this came up today, I'm glad you're here. You stopped in at a convenient time, John. So I'm trying to launch a direct participation program to buy a $10 million ranch and syndicate it with at least 50 different partners, limited partners. And today on the call with the attorneys, I have an outsourced CFO. We're kind of getting everyone introduced and going over the legal structure. And the attorneys built in a lot of earnouts that I had asked for. They'd built in a lot of profit sharing for managers because I believe in economic incentivization. I maybe I'm projecting my values onto people, but I think I'm like, oh, well, if the manager is directly responsible for profitability and productivity, they should be rewarded for that. And there should be some sort of risk to that as well. And my CFO basically shut it down. He said, no, I don't think you need to pay these attorneys in front of them all. He said, I don't think you need to. He is outsourced, so he said, I don't think you need to pay them for any more work. You're building terms, you're building legal parameters in these entities that's unnecessary. You're wasting money with these attorneys. And I still believe that people should be incentivized economically. And I just don't know how you'd create metrics for the more altruistic novel things, but I can do it with cash.
Yeah. And that's a really good question. And I've worked with so many managers over the years, and it kind of runs the gamut. There's been a few, man, I would be more than happy to give them an incentive thing because I know they'd do their very best and they'd do it ethically. You know, they wouldn't rob some part of the operation to make it look profitable. You know, comes down to things like repair and maintenance. I've been on places that repair and maintenance have been shoved aside till you've got this whole backlog
so it looks profitable.
And there's been a few managers, and they were good guys. I liked them, got along well with them, but they were almost too smart and they could figure out how to beat any system. And I mean, not trying to say that's bad, but I mean, that's just human nature.
That's human nature.
It is. Sure. You know, you're going to try and do your best for yourself first, and that's kind of the way it is. I've met other ones that just wanted to do good, honest work, and if they got a really decent salary, not a get-by salary, but something where they could, you know, put away and go towards their future, they'd give you everything they had and do the very best job. So it comes down to you, one size doesn't fit all in that question, because it all comes down to ethics, morals, and belief systems that, you know, whatever the person is who's going to manage. And I've met guys that the money wasn't near as important to them as the lifestyle, the way they lived and what they got to do, and they loved it and they did great jobs. And then I've met others that were geniuses that, oh my goodness, you spent all your time trying to track what they were doing with the books. So, you know,
it just, Enron.
So, you know, it's a tough question, and I don't know that you could just build it into one program. So sometimes, and I've seen a lot of different incentive programs tried, and some were marginally successful. I don't know that I ever saw one that was completely successful, but some were better than others and some were probably worth it.
What are your thoughts, Andy?
Oh man. Well, first of all, on incentivizing management, I mean, you know, you got to, the problem is you're kind of compartmentalizing the operation. Like, how do you incentivize for long-term, you know, maintenance of infrastructure and stuff like that, right? If you're focused on cash flow or profitability, right, then have you cut out, you know, you're going to get a manager that's going to not do all the maintenance and you know.
Well, you know from doing your appraisals that the cap rate on a ranch, 1.5%, whereas the appreciation rate potentially 9% annualized if you time it right and you strike it right and you buy it right. So, I mean, to me, there's almost a disincentive, John, for cash flow. Who gives a shit about 1.5% cap rate when historically your asset is going to appreciate at least 4% a year? And same with just doing nothing. I mean, with the exception of Nebraska and their crazy property taxes, you guys are getting screwed like crazy. But
tell me about it.
Up here at what, Andy, 1/4%?
Yeah, it's, but we're very low on it.
1/4, 1/8% of the asset value. So if you're paying 1/4% in property taxes, you can walk away from that ranch and do absolutely nothing with it while it appreciates at 4% minimum. And you're still going to, you're going to make your return and look like a rock star because of it.
Yep.
Yeah, we see it every day.
Yep. Well, and Andy brought up a good point. You know, how do you incentivize longevity? And say my generation, which is a little above you guys, but our goal when we got onto a place is you showed up there for the most part, unless it was like a cowboying job or something. But if you were going to manage, your goal was to stay there and spend a career there if you liked the people. You know, I mean, it really was about longevity. Now it's a little different. I see the new graduates coming out of some of the programs that are geared towards ranch management. They're looking at their first jobs as stepping stone. Fine, all of them are, the first few. But they look at this 3 to 5 years, 5 years, it's time to move on, go to something bigger, better. There's a different perspective in terms of longevity. This is my personal opinion on what I've observed, is it's that kind of keep moving or you're going to go stagnant. And agriculture in its best form is a lifelong thing, and especially the longer you're on a piece of ground, the better you know it. Not that it's not a bad idea to go see something else once in a while. You should in your career, but realistically, I think by the time you're in your 40s, you should be looking at being on a place that you can, you know, basically retire off of or something like that. You know, do your exploring in your 20s and 30s and learn a lot, see a lot of different things, bring it to the final ranch.
Sow your wild oats, literally.
yeah, that's pretty much it, you know.
Rump Springer.
And that's kind of what my career was. I was like 38 before I quit moving around. And so it's a little hard to figure out how do you get that longevity in and how do you do it. And then generational, and I've seen this on several ranches, where the father would retire and his son had end up taking over the management. You know, he'd been trained there and he might have bounced out and gone somewhere back and forth, real common. But then they'd come in next as the next manager. And he had this continuity for several generations, which had its pluses, but it also some had its minuses. Sometimes, you know, you had to things had to get shook up a little bit because you get stuck in this rut. And we all know that it's good once in a while to jump out of the ruts. Just hope you don't go off a cliff, but it's a good thing. So I don't know how you reward longevity. I really don't.
Well, it definitely seems like this industry is going to continue to develop because there's less and less owner operator all the time and more, you know, outside ownership. That's just the way it's going. So pluses and minuses there too, but ranch management, I think, is, you know, as evidenced by the new programs you mentioned, you know, as a new, it's not a new industry, but just a growing industry. So it'll be interesting to see how it settles in, you know?
Yeah. And I really look forward to watching how management and the type of people and the way they, your dog's not listening to you.
No, he's not.
For those that aren't here in video.
But I'm really tickled with a lot of the, you know, in my, I'm going to call them younger people, but those people in their 20s and 30s that are really starting to get their oar in the water, you're really sharp, really thinking, really on top of it. Think about things differently. And at times it's disconcerting because then I fall back to my old stuck in the mud ideas on things and then go, you know, actually they're right. Dang it. And I'm looking forward to seeing how this evolves. And with the land ownership changes, you know, when my career was evolving, it was mostly family farms and ranches, and you hoped you could get on because one of their kids wouldn't come home. So you'd get a chance to, you know, go to work there and learn and do things. Well, now that's not as common, and we've got more corporate owned, more, you know, absentee owner owned, you know, pick your poison. But it's not the same. And so it takes a different style. And I think this next generation is really geared well to jump into that. And I'm looking forward to seeing how it turns out.
Andy, do you know, this is kind of a tangent here. Do you know if the world population grows by 4 to 6% a year?
No, I don't know what that rate is, but it's, what do you mean? What's the?
Well, if historically these ranches and farms have been appreciating 4 to 6% a year, is that reflective of demand to feed the world? Because I was musing behind the wheel, as you can empathize, John, driving 12 hours, just you and your thoughts, and sometimes AM radio in the rural parts when nothing else will come in. Maybe a little windshield singing, a little windshield microphone.
But, only by myself.
You don't listen to our podcast episodes?
we don't have them on cassette for them.
Eight-track.
So in my musing, I was like trying to create a justification that land doesn't need to produce a yield, that zero cap rate is fine because land is irreplaceably demanded. We have not found a way to replace food and nutrition, and therefore we've not found a way to take out feeding humans. Therefore, land will always be in demand. It's going to have to produce more for a growing world population. And you take commercial real estate and say it's a 12-13% cap rate. Well, commercial real estate, there's substitutes, there's economic, technological obsolescence, there's political risk. If you're in like Seattle or Portland, and now because of leadership administration, your real estate is worth less, and you know, real estate's location, location, location. So there's a lot of risks to commercial real estate that goes into that cap rate. But with land, what is the risk? I mean, there's no risk. We haven't found a way to replace food.
No, you know, and that's an interesting thought. You know, and we've all heard that, you know, in 10 years, we're going to be in a crisis. And that started, you know, 40 years ago, that we're going to be in a crisis. We seem to somehow, as humans, keep able to produce more than we probably should be able to, it seems like, in some regards. We keep doing it. I don't know when that tipping point's going to be. And when all of a sudden the asphalt out here is not worth squat, and that vacant lot might suddenly be worth something.
Yeah, so you know, we start other farming than between the interstates.
Yeah. Oh, I actually did a calculation on that one time, figuring out how many AUMs of grazing capacity there was on the interstate from, I think I was driving from Bozeman with my ex-business partner to Miles City to do
a
job. You
do have too much time on the road.
Oh, yeah. We even calculated how much grass wasn't growing under all the cow pies, figuring out. We didn't have a good radio.
Or cassette player.
Yeah. But, you know, I'm not sure about that either, you know. And at some point, I would think that the ag production part would get to be maybe a little bit more than say some of the commercial. And look what's happened in Billings. You know, I think about when I'd come here as a kid, all the fields that are now just, I mean, miles upon miles of
houses
and lawns. I guess everyone could raise a couple sheep, but yeah, I don't know when that is either. And I keep thinking that there's got to be a correction, a change, or some tipping point.
Well, I think we're a long way from shortage. We produce far more food. I mean, of course, distribution is the problem as far as human starvation goes. But yeah, we're a long way from being short of land and short of food production. So that's why it doesn't enter in the economics. And particularly in Montana, we're not a high yield ag area. I mean, I think maybe cropland in the Midwest and, you know, the breadbasket and the valleys in California and stuff. So a little different. But
yeah, so the demand of that asset for food supply just isn't there. We're just not demanding it from land.
Yeah. No. And that's not the premise of value. I mean, even though there's you know, most of the rural land in Montana is in production value. That's, as we all know,
air quotes, maybe.
That's not the basis of land prices.
Right.
We're far, very disconnected.
Yeah. Emotional, political driven demand is a lot of, I think, where the pricing's at. Especially in Montana, it's all this emotional post-Yellowstone TV show stuff that's probably driven a lot of things.
Yeah, it's too bad season 5 got canceled.
Oh, it really? Did? I didn't know that.
Yeah, I mean, the show is done. Did they do 5 seasons?
No, I don't know.
I don't know.
I never watched it.
I haven't seen it yet either. I've just heard that they're done. And
Kevin Costner
and Taylor Sheridan, their egos were too big. They were too cowboy.
they're working on the regenerative spinoff.
The Polyface Farm.
Maybe that could be maybe this podcast is our launching point, Coulter, yeah, into television entertainment, regenerative.
I don't know. You know, that is a tough question. And I think that we don't know where the tipping point is. And I don't know what the signals are going to be for it. I have no idea. But at some point, there will be a tipping point. Whether it's in my lifetime, your guys' lifetime, I don't know. But there are some things. You know, you mentioned like the valleys in California. You know, that's all, a lot of it's dependent on irrigation water. Well, mm-hmm. Water's getting to be, you know, such a big thing just because, you know, think about how much water just like Billings here uses now compared to 40 years ago. And so, you know, and water in a lot of the West is the key to production. You know, otherwise you're running boom and bust, you know, on those kind of cycles. And what that means, I have no idea. But I think at some point it will come to a head, but it may be a while yet.
Well, I'm going to throw in a wild card here. I mean, before the big, you could call it the big amenity push maybe in the land market, right? So what would that have been maybe 30 years ago? Mm-hmm. You know, before 40, 50 years ago, ag production was more the basis, right?
Right.
But at that time, and you know, ranchers and farmers and, you know, would puff up their chest and talk about efficiency and what, or, you know, and whether they were a legitimate financial operation. But it seems to me like a lot of that, you know, efficiency in agriculture was kind of a selective term. It was high input. Like, it seems like a lot of guys in that generation, I don't know why they didn't teach this in ag school, but it didn't seem like production at any cost was kind of the driving force.
Yep.
And so I guess I should maybe use the term productive rather than efficient. So, you know, you could stick your chest out far if you were productive, no matter what input costs you had. So I look back at that whole era as, you know, a little bit of skepticism. Was it really that efficient? Really? Cause it just all these, and the inputs were so much cheaper and you could argue were subsidized and that kind of stuff. So is this regenerative, you know, then the amenity thing kind of comes in and changes the matrix, and now we're looking at a regenerative. So are our ideas of efficiency changing and evolving and really making more sense over time?
Well, I really think that in some regards it is. You know, compared to, let's just pick 30 years ago, was probably about the time 30, 40 years ago when, I mean, everybody was throwing every fertilizer,
right.
You know, you had every kind of herbicide in the world and all that. And then you get into the livestock thing and, you know, you'd go to the cafe and a bunch of ranchers and they're in the fall. I just hated it because you'd sit there and they're saying, oh yeah, my calves went, you know, 5, 5.50. And so they're going, well, what did you put into them to do that? Well, we calved in January and then fed a lot of hay all winter. And then there's this other poor guy that calved in May or June, and he had, you know, 4 weight calves. Well, no one bragged about the profit per calf. It was all about the weight or the bushels per acre. And you still see a little of that, like these corn growing competitions. Drives me crazy. I read about them in the deals once in a while. I go, you got to be kidding me. But people are starting to look at that, and I lay a lot of that, you know, to like Alan Savory, Stan Parsons, and that, of course, became Ranching for Profit, Stan Parsons stuff, to actually look at what are you actually really making and look at those overheads and can you change your operation, and why calve in February and 2 foot of snow when you could maybe do it in May and it might get rained on is the worst.
So part of my point in all that was, you know, we can look back and say, oh, things had a stronger basis in economics or that this amenity or regenerative kind of faddish, you know, where I guess that's our concern is that it might be a fad or faddish has come in and value driven, that kind of stuff. But hasn't it always been value driven? It might be different values now, but, and you can poke holes in these values if you look at them hard enough. So mm-hmm. the productivity, value set maybe of 40 years ago, you know, we can, from this vantage point, we can look back and point, poke holes in, and is the regenerative quote unquote sustainable, you know, just a different set of values. And, you know, is it better or worse? Don't know, but.
Yeah. No value judgment here.
Yeah.
We're not going to take a position on that subjectivity. It's just, it is what it is.
Right. Yeah. Right. There's always been, I guess part of my point is, has there not always been, a somewhat subjective, values driven basis behind land and land ownership and mm-hmm. agriculture since day one?
No, I think you're right. You know, and it's, you know, 40 years ago, 50 years ago, whatever, ag value and its productivity value was a big part of driving what land prices were. But then people, as we got more, this is my opinion, but as people got more crowded, there was more, you know, big urban deals and all this, they started to value land for its other attributes, you know, open space, wildlife got to be maybe a little bit more of a deal, and all those kind of things that are non-ag production based. Those values started to get recognized and put on a higher level than before. And that's really, of course, we've really seen it here in this state in the last, you know, 15, 20 years in particular. And values are values, you know, I mean, you pay for what you value. You know, I looked at a book at a used bookstore down here that, you know, to me was well worth the money. Most people go, there's no way I'm paying $300 for a book, but yeah. It was my value that I thought it was worth mm-hmm. that. I didn't buy it, believe me.
You know, it used to be hard to live in the country too. You know, vehicles yeah. and roads weren't what they are, and cell phones and shared phone line. You know, I remember I had family in Lewistown and it was a shared phone line in town when I was a kid.
Yeah.
Like, you had to pick up the phone and talk to, you know, like.
Yeah, when I was a kid and lived on my mother's family's farm, we had a party line. And I just always remember my cousin would be trying to call in to get grain prices and sell grain, and he'd have to, oh my gosh, they're still on the phone. That'd go on for about a half hour till he'd finally lose and say, hey, could you break off? I need to sell some grain.
You just cost me 3 cents a bushel.
And pickup trucks were a lot less comfy and
everything was less comfy.
So okay, here's a question for both of you. Given what you've seen over the last 40 years, the changes that have taken place.
I'm only 37 years old, but go on.
I didn't think you were supposed to lie on this show.
I could make a joke about dating, but I'm not going to. So as the GP, I'm going to be the GP of this direct participation program. I have to put in 2% hurt money. I have to put in my own skin in the game. I choose to. I want to have an alignment of interest with the limited partners and show that I'm literally putting my money where my mouth is. Would you guys rather own something in Northeast Montana or Southwest Montana? Where are you long? If it were your 2% in the DPP, and mind you, like, I'm not going to live there. I'm not going to reap any other benefits from this. It's just purely financial on paper driven. No other amenities, attributes, benefits for me. Just pure economic, monetary. Where are you long?
My first reaction is Northeast Montana, that Southwest Montana is probably, I mean, everything has, of course, risen in cost basis, and, you know, the tide has risen in everywhere. So it's all relative, but I think perhaps a little stronger in Southwest Montana. The cost to value ratio, I'm wondering, is, you know, Southwest Montana has been hit hard.
It has, Southwest Montana has more blue sky in their pricing and everything else.
Yeah.
You know, Northeast Montana, not the easiest place in the world to do agriculture, but there's a lot of families hung in for a lot of years. And, you know, it just depends how quick do you want some kind of return. What are the goals for the limited partners? I mean, why do they want to do it? Is it strictly economics, or is there a other component to it that they like? Because that will drive a lot of what can happen and where you're going to be. they may not be happy up there. I mean, it's not the easiest place to live. I know, I've been there.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, selling this, marketing it, the marketability, there's other reasons and goals and attributes for drawing participants. I'm looking at just strictly asset values. And Andy, I'm kind of surprised that you are on an annualized basis. It sounds like you are longer areas that have been, though, kind of like the stock market and commodity markets, high values create high volatility. When things rise significantly, they can fall further, is kind of what I heard from you.
I can't help but laugh. You know, I was at that, there was a land auction a couple weeks ago in Circle, Montana, which is north central, northeast Montana. And you know, you're in a small community when an hour after the auction, the auctioneer, the seller, the buyer, and the outside appraiser are sitting around drinking, having belly laughs. That's kind of unique.
Yeah.
And that's what you still have in northeast, you know, Montana. But I can tell you, I mean, I had some drinks with the buyer, and he couldn't help the questions slip out. Like, did I just make a big mistake, or kind of deal, or, you know, how the pricing felt high to him. Yeah. Right. But what's the alternative? And we're, you know, it's up everywhere for sure. But,
Well, another aspect to it, too, is the longevity of this project you're looking at. Is this a 10-year get-in, get-out kind of thing, you know, and just write off whatever appreciation comes to it and hopefully a little profit? Or is this something that might run out 30 years or more? Because then that will change, because I suspect, I don't know this, but I suspect at some point more of the plains country, you know, out of the sexy mountain stuff and more out on the plains, are going to start to attract a certain cadre of people that, you know, might be willing to pay for something out there to have a little more room, not as much glitz. And
it's going to be pristine where the mountain areas aren't.
Right.
Yeah. And with, you guys mentioned pickups getting better and communication getting better, internet reaching the rural areas with Starlink.
Oh, yeah.
I think their life is... Life on the Northern Great Plains was always really hard.
Yeah.
That was just incredibly difficult. And that's why I use the extremes, the polarity of Southwest Montana versus Northeast Montana.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that life is getting easier up there because of technology.
Can you find a pocket out of the wind? That'd be a ringer.
Can you make money on the wind?
Yeah, there you go.
Do you want the wind to go away, or do you want to harvest it and sell that energy?
Yeah. No, and that, you know, and that's a question for a lot of those kind of things, you know, and it's no different. I'm kind of hoping that the Sandhills catch on at some point, not to the level it did here, because I'll get shot if I say too much about that.
Yeah. But, your fault.
Yeah.
You leaked it.
There he is. He's the one. He said it.
You leaked it on a Ranch Investor podcast and it was over.
I'm already controversial enough down there. But no, I mean, I think that there's potential for that on the long term. If it's a short play, then there's other things you can do. But if it's a long-term play, there's nothing wrong with that. And you're right. You know, I mean, it's a lot easier up there now. You know, I mean, used to be we had one television station when I lived up there, and it was kind of fuzzy. Well, now, you know, I mean, I remember when satellite TV came in, a few people had it, and it was like, whoa, there's that out there. It's amazing.
Hey, we used to call it the Montana State Flower when I was a kid, the satellite dishes. Remember the big ones?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, John, you're from Glasgow. And
yeah.
Glasgow is in NBC as being the most isolated town in the lower 48.
Yeah, it can feel that way at times.
Have they ever been to Jordan?
Yeah, I was going to say
Jordan or Cohagen, but
Jordan didn't make the list because they were under 1,000, or I think. Well, that's where I'm at, and I hope to stay in touch with you guys on it.
Yeah, that'd be great.
There's plenty of other considerations there, as you mentioned, and one of the considerations to sell this, I was thinking of it as asset protection.
Mm-hmm.
What is the underlying asset going to do for maintaining and holding its value or appreciating at a higher rate than comparables or alternatives? So that's kind of the baseline of the decision. But actually, to sell this, I'm going to have to offer some sort of recreational benefit, because mm-hmm. as we know, what's driving the market, we suspect it's recreation and amenities, and that's quality of life, that's peace, open space, hunting, recreation, and so there will be that aspect to it. And so then, obviously, as you guys both know, that takes you more into timbered, mountain, pristine, proximity to town. There's all those factors. Proximity to the airport. Probably don't want to buy a ranch that you're going to hunt once a year and then have to drive to Billings, or fly into Billings and then drive another 2.5 hours, figure out a rental car and all that.
Yeah.
You're just going to have to put in a jet strip on the place, and there go those other costs. Those
John just talked about being a good neighbor. and what I've learned is neighbors who have jet strips, I don't know if I want them as a neighbor.
I was in Jackson Hole just a week ago, and I saw one big-ish plane come in and out of that airport, but they were all small private jets, mm-hmm. one after another.
It's amazing how much of that goes on. Even, you know, my place there is just west of Valentine, 11 miles, and so many private jets fly into Valentine now. Mm. They're building another big hangar just so guys can park them in there, not get them hailed out, you know, when they're down golfing or whatever, because there's a bunch of golf courses there. Mm. But it just amazes me how many private jets, and then go to Bozeman, and it seems like there's more of those than commercial jets now.
Yeah,
it's just a nonstop. So it's fairly common.
Well, to get John in a little trouble here, the sand hills of Nebraska are gorgeous. Timber, live water, springs, streams. And Andy, did you know that they have elk?
I did know that. I heard that. Yep.
There's elk in the Nebraska sand hills. So we leaked it here, and John, you're in trouble.
And there's really good golfing if you like to golf.
But it hasn't really tipped as far as just high demand area?
No.
Far from everything?
It's a little too far. You know, Valentine's a pretty small town, nice town, a lot of good business. If you can't find it there, you probably don't really need it, but it's nice sometimes to go to a bigger town. But there's a lot of recreation down there and things to do, but it hasn't caught on as a place that, you know, people want to come by and then just show up once or twice a year. But and then you have to enjoy, some of it's really remote, and I lived on some of the more remote places out there, and yeah, it's a ways to town and it's a whole different lifestyle, but great place.
Doesn't quite really have the bragging rights as Montana, that part of the
the brand name. Lacking the brand name.
Yeah, it just doesn't have that cachet. I wished I could think of it. They had some saying, it was basically like, come to Nebraska, why not, or something like that one time, and I kind of laughed at it because there's so much to do there and a lot of fun, but and really good people.
I found an old marketing, I guess it would be, or promotional button in my dad's estate for Billings, probably 40, 50 years old, says, let Billings happen to you.
Yeah.
That's profound.
Yeah. Yeah. Not sure that would fly today, you know, just different era.
Yeah. Well, thanks for coming on, John.
Oh, you bet. It's a pleasure.
Yeah, good nice to have to you back. Up. And are you still not open for business?
Well,
are you on LinkedIn?
I'm tied up. Yeah, I'm on LinkedIn.
Can you be solicited on LinkedIn?
Yeah, that's the best way to get hold of me. And I haven't updated that site for 10 months or something, which I probably should do. But I check LinkedIn about once every 2 weeks. So don't expect a rapid response. I've kind of killed off my computer use as much as possible, just having fun doing what I'm doing. So.
Well, I appreciate you coming on, and got to get Andy's plug in here as well.
For Montana Land Source?
Montana Land Source.
Yeah. Well, exciting things like, it's been a while since I've been on the podcast, but yeah, released a new map app and interesting times in the market. I mean, I'm starting to call it the Great Correction.
Okay, tell me more.
Yeah.
Well, actually tell John more, because I really got to go to the bathroom.
Well, we were talking a little bit before the mics were on, but just how incredibly slow this market has become and how little volume is out there. And it's just all kind of crept to a halt. But and a little bit of indication of maybe some value declines in certain spheres and stuff. But it's really just kind of holding. You know, we were just so overheated over the last 2 years. It's just sorting itself out.
Well, and does the general economy, you know, some of the ups and downs of the stock market, the interest rates, all that's playing into it and getting everyone to look a little closer before they jump?
That's right. I was asked recently about interest rates because most ranches in Montana are bought with cash, not with financing.
Right.
So you would think those would be decoupled, but I think it's more a general economic. And again, I said it at the beginning of the podcast, I think, you know, so, you know, brokers will say that demand is there, that they got buyers, they just can't find what they want. But I just think it's the great pencil sharpening season or year for that. We're, you know, in correction after such an overheated market. And I think the buyers are just getting real picky and just want what they want. And of course, we still have an issue with, you know, a lot of people who would be sellers want to replace. And that's hard to do.
Yeah.
So that's holding everything up.
Right.
You know, if you can't replace it, then you can't, you know, go through with the sale. So it's sort of chicken and an egg.
Yep.
But everything's just kind of on hold and just seems to be in hold mode.
Well, and I would think, too, that those that are actually taking the time to really sharpen their pencil and get after the numbers are seeing input costs of just, you know, are through the roof compared to, say, five years ago. I was at a car dealership having one of my vehicles worked on, and while I was waiting, I walked through the lot out there and about had a heart attack when I saw what they're asking for one-ton trucks now. You know, it's just amazing what just simple things like that, not to mention your fuel, fertilizers,
right,
anything else. So
yeah, I don't know if these, you know, some of these buyers will fall out, like, you know, kind of realize they're not looking for what they thought they were looking for, or if they're just going to hold on to the patience and get the property that's right when it comes along, kind of thing. I mean, and it's so low inventory that I guess it's hard to get an accurate bead on demand, because demand is always, you know, up when things are scarce.
Right.
Right. Yep. So, and we're seeing a little, you know, we're seeing inventory rebuild just, but boy, at a really anemic rate.
Mm-hmm.
So, yep. Yeah, it'll be interesting to see going through the summer.
Yeah,
if any of that shifts, or I think this is kind of the new normal for a while for this year, probably.
Well, at least. What do you think the upcoming? You know, we're going to have elections here before too long, and everyone gets all jittery before that. Is that something you see as playing into this possibly?
Compounding effects?
Yeah,
I can't stand an election cycle in the real estate business. It is such a cop out excuse.
Yeah,
people use that so much.
Yeah. Yeah. It is kind of weird. It's
And when, I mean, if, Andy, if you ever did a correlation, covariance, you know, regression analysis, when has an election ever affected the land values and to what degree?
It's minimal.
Yeah. The market's more powerful than that.
You know, it does seem like sometimes during an election cycle, added to the end of the year. You know, like I think when Biden was elected, you know, it was like there were guys hot to get something done by the end of the year, because for sure, you know, a Democratic regime was going to
taxes were going up.
So got to do it this year kind of thing. You know, so I've seen a little bit of that, but it's not very significant in the long arc of, I think you're right. It's just a lot of. You know, I'll just throw in one thing on that, though. I was hanging out with a bunch of brokers for a while in Jackson Hole, and a lot of story swapping, you know, just great old stories from a lot of these older ranch brokers. And it really did occur to me what a people business it is, and how emotion, and because a lot of the stories, you know, had to do with, of course, crazy characters and crazy choices and crazy decisions. But it made me realize, like, the idea that it's all based on rational, you know, supply and demand and economics, kind of like, no, it's people and all kinds of craziness that brings.
Yeah. It's a lot of different observations normalized over an analysis.
Yeah.
And we only have to deal with them for a few months. John has to deal with them for a few years.
He was talking about retiring on places. It's a lifelong endeavor.
Well, I better get my plug in as well. And that is, if you are an accredited investor looking to invest $100,000 to $200,000, and you'd be interested in a direct participation program for a $10 million ranch, hit me up on one of our channels, social media, my email, phone, LinkedIn, and like to have a conversation to hear where you're at, what would motivate you and be interesting.
Yeah, and I need to do a better job plugging Montana Land Source. MTLandSource.com is the best resource out there for what's happening in the Montana land market. We map every ranch, every large acreage property that's on the market. It's the only place where everything that's on the market is in one place, and we've got stats, and we sell subscriptions for access to inside information on the rural Montana land market. So if you're in the industry or interested in Montana Land Source, check us out. We're a great resource.
Some of the listings I am interested in putting under contract for this are on Montana Land Source. So if Andy hasn't scared you off with volatility and if your desires to have a legacy asset passed down for generations and somewhere to go with your family annually, reliably, let me know. I'd like to hear what that looks like for you. And do visit Montana Land Source and sharpen your pencil, because we're going to do this. Thanks, John, for coming on. Well,
thank you for inviting me.
Click subscribe on your streaming platform so you know when the latest episode has dropped. Be the source of knowledge and the maven that other professionals are excited to refer.